Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes from Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, December the 17th. It's our final show of the year. On Spectator TV today, London has gone into Tier 3, but only for a few days. Does the Christmas easing still make sense? I'll be speaking to the Spectator's political team and hearing from Professor Tim Spector, a genetic epidemiologist at King's College in London. We return to the economics of Scottish independence with Andrew Wilson, former member of the Scottish Parliament for the SNP and author of that party's Scottish Growth Commission. And finally, we wrap up the year by going over the highs and lows of 2020 with Spectator columnist Rod Little. Now, subscribe to The Spectator in our Christmas sale and you'll receive 12 weeks of the magazine in print and online, plus a bottle of Paul Roger champagne worth £46 for just £12. It's going to be the Christmas gift of the year. Please note this is a UK-only offer and our terms and conditions apply, all of which can be read on our website. So to claim your 12 weeks of The Spectator and your free bottle of champagne, go to spectator.co.uk/cheers, and you will be cheered if you do that. And if you do subscribe before Sunday the 19th, I know it's not long to go, so you will have to hurry, you'll also receive this year's Christmas edition as a bonus. It's a triple edition. It's packed with fantastic reading to get you through the holiday season. Now, a very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes into next year. Yes, they're going to continue to sponsor us in 2021. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange, and we're delighted to be partners with them. Okay, let's turn to COVID. This week, London and parts of the Southeast have gone into Tier 3, but only briefly. From the 23rd, families across the UK can bubble, as we say these days, with two other households for 5 days. The four nations of the UK thought about cancelling Christmas, but ultimately they decided against it. Was that the best reason? Was that the best decision? I'm joined by James Forsyth, Spectator's political editor, Katie Bowles, the Spectator's deputy political editor. James, there was a time when the idea was that all four nations of the United Kingdom would have roughly the same approach to Christmas. Is that still the case?
Andrew, it's not. In Wales, they're going to change the law to limit these bubble sizes to two households. And then I think you see very slightly different guidance in Scotland and England. In Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon is urging people not to stay overnight. She's urging people really to avoid seeing their families. She's talking about how she will go for a walk with her parents rather than sitting down for Christmas dinner with them. And I think you've seen Boris Johnson go far further than he normally does in terms of kind of urging people to show restraint and personal responsibility. You had him saying in his press conference yesterday, have a merry little Christmas, with the emphasis on little. You had Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, out this morning on the broadcast round, urging people not to travel from high infection areas to low infection areas. And I think there is a reality here, is if the four nations had known what they know now about where infections currently are, and crucially, the vaccine news that we've had in recent weeks, I doubt that on the 24th of November, they would have agreed to such a liberalisation of the rules for this 5-day period. Now, I think it's very easy to kind of pontificate. I think they were in a very difficult position because, you know, if you look anthropologically, ever since people have lived in this part of Europe, we know that they have had a celebration in the middle of winter to essentially cheer themselves up amidst the grey and the gloom of the weather. And so it would definitely have kind of gone against the grain of human nature to have tried to kind of keep the rules in place over Christmas. But I think given that by Easter, the most vulnerable should have been vaccinated, I think there really was a case of saying to everyone, look, hold your heels. You know, there is light at the end of a tunnel. Let's be restrained this Christmas. And the Easter weekend is a 4-day bank holiday. Let's all knock ourselves out then.
Katie, I get the impression, I mean, I find it all very complicated and confusing now, so what we're meant to do and what we're not meant to do, particularly in which nation we're in. I mean, are we in a situation now where ministers, including the Prime Minister, they kind of regret that they decided to ease up at Christmas? They're getting a lot of scientific advice now that they shouldn't have and that they should tighten up again. but that they've concluded that politically that's too difficult.
I think that roughly sums up where we are. I think that if you had the gift of hindsight here, I'm not sure the Prime Minister would have announced it, such an expansive or relatively expansive Christmas relaxation programme. But ultimately, Downing Street got to the point where were you to listen to scientific advisers saying that in a way there should be no relaxation from the tier system, you would face the wrath of many people and many voters who had made plans based on government guidance. And I think that's an issue in all of this, which is while the polls keep showing a majority for the tightest restrictions, often all the most, you know, draconian measures, there was obviously a large portion of the public who had made plans. And I think that's why the government found itself in a bit of a hole on this. I also do think that Boris Johnson is someone who deep down beneath all his tier systems does love the idea of freedom and people being able to choose to do things. But yes, I think that if it was a few weeks ago now and they could see what was going to happen in terms of the pace of rates, then actually perhaps we would have either had a stricter tier system or a longer lockdown in the build up to Christmas, or you would have fewer households and a shorter time period.
James, there must be a fear in government circles, maybe from 10 Downing Street downwards, that the easing up at Christmas is going to lead to a lot more new cases in January or early in the new year. That could coincide with either a second wave that hasn't really gone away or a third wave that is all on its way. And that the prospect, although the vaccine has been our great hope and that will continue to be rolled out, that the prospect of some kind of lockdown, some series of restrictions between now and Easter looks inevitable.
Andrew, this sentiment doesn't match your jumper, but I think the first few months of next year are going to be the toughest period we've seen so far in fighting the virus, because you are going to see this third wave essentially coincide with the usual winter pressures on the NHS. And we haven't yet, because of when the virus first came to the UK, seeing the NHS trying to deal both with its usual winter stresses and strains and COVID. And that, I think, is what could make January and February so grim. I think you see how worried the government is by the suggestion that schools, which they've been determined to try and keep open since they shut them in the first lockdown, with, I think, kind of truly kind of awful effects in terms of educational inequality and the like, are going to go back a week late in January, so they can try and get this kind of testing system set up in schools. But I don't mean to depress everyone before Christmas, but I really do think that January and February are going to be quite acutely grim months. And I would be very surprised if on our final show in February we aren't talking about a third lockdown that the UK has experienced. I think if you just look at what is happening in Holland, in Germany, where hospitals in Saxony are having to triage oxygen, you know, this is getting really bad. And I think it is highly likely, look at what's happening in Wales, you know, and the fact that tier three does not seem to be having the effect in the Medway towns in Kent that people had hoped in terms of bringing cases down. I think it is likely that we are either going to end up with a really tightened up tier system, I can't believe it's not lockdown, or a third national, England-wide lockdown.
Well, I think that's grimly realistic, James, but perhaps the government will be hoping that all its views on global warming are accurate and that January and February may be unseasonably mild, and that should help the NHS and everything.
I don't mean to depress everyone further, but January and February are unseasonably mild. We'll probably have more flooding, which would add further pressures onto the British state.
Well, thank you, Scrooge, for these words.
I'm a right barrel of laughter.
No, I think what you say, I mean, the next 3 months of the first 3 months of next year are clearly going to be tough. And it is remarkable how, you know, last spring we thought, well, by the middle of the summer, late summer, things will be getting back to normal. Then we thought, well, by the end of autumn, we'll be getting back to normal. Now we're saying, well, maybe by Easter, we'll be back to normal. It's this pandemic has proved to be much stickier than those of us who are not specialists thought. Before I go to Professor Spector, let me just ask you, James and Katie, Brexit, where are we now? We learned this morning that President Macron has tested positive for COVID. Is that a bit of a spanner in the works?
It could be a spanner in the works if you're looking at the timeline. However, despite this, there is still a sense of optimism, I think, among Tory MPs. A little less, but still, I would say, more optimistic than last week amongst officials. And Tory MPs and MPs generally are getting to go home for the Christmas holidays, not too far if they're following the guidelines. But they are being warned that they could be recalled, they could be asked to come back to Parliament anytime in the next, you know, few days, really, if there is a deal. They just need 48 hours notice. And I think there is a sense, particularly if you heard the way Boris Johnson was talking in the chamber yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions, when the SNP's Ian Blackford brought up, the economic damage of Brexit. Boris Johnson has had this regular refrain recently where he keeps saying that, no deal is the default option. And actually, he was talking a bit more about a deal this time. And I think there is a sense that the shape of a deal is there. There's been movement on level playing field, but fisheries still remains a sticking point. So in a way, perhaps we're roughly back to where we were a week and a half ago when UK officials thought that level playing field was nearly resolved and fisheries was the main problem. Then lots of things went wrong, blamed on Emmanuel Macron. But if Emmanuel Macron is on his sick bed, he may not be able to cause, too many disagreements in the coming days.
No, you're right. I'm not sure it's a plus or a minus. I mean, he is apparently still working, but in isolation in the Elysee and still dealing with his advisors. But of course, it can, as our Prime Minister found out, it can hit you badly. And it's quite difficult to keep on working. James, just finally on Brexit from you, I see that there is the makings of some kind of deal on the level playing field, the state subsidies, rules, regulations that the British may well be able to accept, which would then leave fish, as Katie was saying there. It would be huge and incredible, almost a bizarre failure of statecraft if we ended up without a deal because of fish.
Yeah, and I think if the level playing field is also, I think Angela Merkel has been very reluctant to kind of assert herself too much during this Brexit process. But I think if it is coming down to fish and the French stumbling block, I think you will see Angela Merkel and Ursula von der Leyen prepared to put some pressure on Emmanuel Macron, saying, look, come on, we can't let this whole agreement fail because of fish. Look, and I think there is clearly progress. Michel Barnier has been terribly downbeat whenever briefing the EU side during this process. This morning, he referred to good progress made in the talks, which is the most positive he's sounded in a very long time. I think one of the things that's going to make it difficult to tell when there's going to be a deal or not is that there are essentially two negotiations going on fish. One is the UK-EU negotiation on fish, and then one is the kind of intra-EU negotiation on how much the French, the Belgium and the Danes, who are probably going to be the biggest losers from this, and the Irish as well, should be compensated within the CFP. And I think one of the theories is that the reasons that the Danes and the Dutch have been kicking up particularly rough on fishing is they want to say, look, don't think you're going to compensate the French from our quota share. So I think there are two negotiations going on fish simultaneously here. And it's kind of well worth watching that.
Well, our MPs better not have too much Christmas put because they could be back in the Commons if a deal is done between Christmas and New Year to vote it through. They haven't got much time left. Now, Professor Tim Spector is an epidemiologist. His company, Zoe, has been behind the COVID symptoms app developed by King's College London, which collates its own data from millions of people self-reporting the symptoms every day, allowing Professor Spector's team to follow a pretty up-to-date picture of the infection around the country. Professor, welcome to Spectator TV. I know it's a busy time of the year, so we're grateful to get your time. Tell us a bit more about the work that is done at Zoe with the COVID symptoms app.
We launched on the 24th of March, the first day of lockdown, and we were about the only game in town, the only app that was out there that was able to gather data on people. And within 24 hours, we had 1 million downloads and now have 4 million subscribers, of which about 1 million are giving us near daily reports. And this, combined with getting people, when they get symptoms, tested rapidly, allows us to get a running, in real time, estimates of what's going on around the country in a way that the other systems don't. We do track the ONS study, the government's official survey that goes into households. So we get very similar estimates, but we're normally about 4 or 5 days ahead of them.
And so, tell me, what divergences do you see, if there are divergences, between the data you are garnering and the official government data that we tend to look at either on the daily cases and deaths cases or in the ONS figures and so on? What are the differences?
Well, we very few differences with the ONS data, but we do see differences with the confirmed cases. So the problem with the confirmed cases is that total goes up and down somewhat erratically because there's no denominator. There's no fixed number of tests they do, and they look at the percentages, because once an outbreak starts, then more people get tested, people get nervous, and they find more cases. So I think at the moment, using just these confirmed cases, which is nice for media headlines and as like deaths, doesn't give the full picture and often exaggerates rapid changes going up or down. And so I think our data in the ONS is a better guide to actually what's happening and doesn't show as bleak a picture as often is portrayed with the deaths and the confirmed cases. So, you know, the ideas of these massive surges in London aren't borne out by our data. We are seeing increases, which are worrying, but we're not seeing increases in the over 60s. We're recording hospital admissions because we were told by the government that these five parameters to assess tiers would be transparent and given out to everybody, but that hasn't materialized. So we're on the app providing that to users, and anyone who logs into our app gets the full report. So we're trying to be more transparent, so people, we believe people will act responsibly if they're given the data. And at the moment, they're not being given the data, they're just being given a bit of a stick. And so that's generally what we're up against. And looking at our data over the last few months, we are able to look at certain patterns and realize that, you know, certain decisions about lockdowns, etc., or Welsh fire breaks, you know, have actually failed or were taken prematurely, as Katie mentioned earlier, that sometimes these big decisions are taken too early without the latest data. And by the time they find out, everything's changed. And then, you know, the data are retrofitted to go with that decision. So I think you need to look at all the data and get the most up-to-date data, I think, is really important, because there are huge differences across the country. And we talk about it as if there's only one, you know, these massive regions, or the UK is one thing. But we're predicting by Christmas there'll be tenfold differences across the country in how likely your local bubble is to have COVID. And, you know, and that should make, and having one rule for everybody when there's a 10 times different rate of infection, to me, doesn't make much sense. And we do need perhaps a more local, regional way of doing this, although I understand it's difficult politically.
That's fascinating. Let me ask you a question about what your data can tell us about the second wave, but also a question about now. I'll begin with the second wave. If we look at the government data and we listen to the politicians and the scientific advisors around them, I think a lot of us have been quite surprised by the scale of the second wave and by the virulence and by the longevity of it. But we're surprised from a position of no expertise. What does your data tell us about, how do you see the second wave through your data?
We're seeing that if we take the UK as a whole, we are seeing it so far is less causing less problems than the first wave. It's affecting young people more than old people. It's causing less hospitalizations. We're not seeing, with a few exceptions of a few trusts, we're not seeing most hospitals being overrun. And we're seeing big differences between areas that we didn't see as much in the first wave, possibly because of areas that were hit very badly in the first wave, like central London, not having as much problem in the second wave because of some relative immunity. So it's a different picture. But as we've seen, the thing here is we're seeing that as these restrictions have been relaxed, strengthened, then relaxed very quickly, which we didn't happen in the first wave, we're seeing these major rebounds. like we're seeing in Wales, where it looks like post-fire break, things are twice as bad as they were before. We think this is related to people's behaviour who, you know, knowing that we have this extraordinary position in this country where we announce some new tier system coming in, and all the pubs will shut in 3 days' time and get surprised that people go out and meet their mates in the next few days. And then we lock them down for again. And we see these very much behavioural effects that I don't think have been taken into account. So looking at the data, we'd say it's a big mistake to keep turning these screws up and down. And looking at the first bit of the second wave, it looks like the decision to have a national lockdown wasn't really justified anyway, because it was coming down in the north already before that at quite a fast rate. So I think, you know, it's easy with retrospect to look at this, and I think it's a really tricky problem for government. But I think we do have the data to enable us to learn lessons going forward. And I think it would be not to keep turning the tap on and off. It would be to actually have some regulations until Easter that makes sense and give people this local information about what's going on in their hospital, what the rates are, you know, what their real risk is. And I think that's where we're hoping to do that with the Zoe app.
It would seem what you're saying, Professor, is that the government needs better data, more reliable data on which to base its decisions. And once it's based decisions on that more, the kind of more reliable data you're talking about, there should then should be an element of consistency in whatever lockdown or restrictions there's going to be, that we should abandon this, what we've called here on Spectator TV, the sort of hokey-cokey of in and out, shaking all about. Would that be a fair summary of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have to also set, you know, we have to set some idea of what the actual, what's the aim? What is the outcome here? Is it just to stop levels, you know, as the media calls it, surging, and everyone gets in a panic? Or is it actually to say, help, you know, stop the NHS from being overrun where it can no longer cope? And at the moment, that is based on, you know, a couple of parameters, numbers of people over 60 with the disease and the percentage of people in hospital with COVID. And at the moment, they're at manageable levels. And if we need to keep a much more, but we need better data on that, which isn't being provided at more local level. I can only get the regional level at the moment. And I think that would tell people how to behave long term without these big behavioural fluctuations. And people would be able to plan things. And I think that's the big difference. And also realising that national lockdowns, you know, effectively someone's worked out that cost the same as the whole NHS budget for a month. So you could have doubled the year's budget in the NHS, increased capacity. And someone needs to start thinking about the bigger picture here, about the pros and cons of doing this stuff rather than knee-jerk reactions because, you know, suddenly deaths go up in one region, you know, overnight. And I think that's what's needed, is a longer-term view, using all the data and perhaps getting, you know, people from different disciplines, economists and other behavioural scientists, more involved in some of these decisions.
Well, let me bring you right up to date then. Health Secretary Matt Hancock said this week that in some parts of England, there's a doubling of infections every 7 days, and he used that stat to justify moving London and the southeast of England into tier three. Does the data justify that, Professor?
Our data doesn't, no. But in if you take London, overall it's doubling every month, our last count. But there are some regions, the northeast, where it is doubling every week or 10 days. But you can always post hoc find data to support what's a decision. And I think that's generally what's happening here. And the question is, do you lock down, you know, the decision was made to lock down 9 million people when in fact there are these particular hotspot areas that are very alarming. But, that you know, there's a sixfold difference even in London between the rates of new infections. So it is complicated, and I think people need to find out what the local data is in their area. And if you can stop people moving between areas, you know, that should be doable. So I do think we need a longer term approach to this that isn't locking everything down crippling the economy for areas that have very low levels of infection. And I think, you know, that's the big message here this Christmas. In a way, you do want different rules for different areas. And I think, you know, it may sound unfair, but that's the scientific argument.
Professor, on the basis of the data you're gathering and then looking forward into January and February, there are fears that I've referred to that the Christmas easing up will lead to a spike or a resurgence in cases. And then there is also talk of a third wave. I think you have some views on that yourself. What does January, February look like to you?
Well, I'm not as worried about seasonal flu as James was. All the data show that we're at 10% of the normal rates of respiratory infections. So it just shows you that we can prevent the normal colds and flus. You know, I haven't had a cold all year. It's fantastic.
And that's because we're not mixing because of COVID.
Exactly.
We're just reducing the flu infection.
So we're not going to get a massive influx of flu that was feared. And most people thought we would, but they haven't factored in our amazing behavioural changes. So I think it's going to be really all about COVID. This will come in, you know, I think we will get rid of this second wave. And I think there will be a lull. And we will see another one probably in February. But I believe it's going to be less than the first two. A quarter of all the infections are now coming from hospitals and care homes. So if those staff are taken out of the equation, then we won't be getting the deaths or anything else. So I think things are going to look up. The infection's still going to be around, but deaths and the severe consequences will get better. So I've got a slightly more optimistic message for Christmas if we all behave.
Very well, Professor. Thank you very much, Professor Spector. Thank you for joining us here on Spectator TV, and a very Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
Now, remember, you can go to spectator.co.uk/cheers to get our Christmas offer. 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, a free bottle of Port Roger champagne, the champagne of Winston Churchill. Terms and conditions apply. Now, in November, The Spectator published a pro-Scottish independence article. It was the first in a long time, by Andrew Wilson, former member of the Scottish Parliament with the SNP. He chairs the Sustainable Growth Commission, the SGC, is an SNP-funded research unit to look into the economics of an independent Scotland. Andrew Wilson, welcome to the programme here on Spectator TV. Let me start. Is it still SNP policy to continue using the pound sterling outside of the UK monetary union for an unspecified period after independence?
Thank you for having me on, Andrew. It's much appreciated. I'm sorry I'm not wearing as convivial a jumper. I will do next time. Yes, it is. So that the idea there is to be honest about the transition that will be needed to move towards independence, learning all of the lessons from Brexit, really, which is to state we know that in doing so, we wouldn't have sovereignty over monetary policy. The Bank of England's independent anyway, but that is a price worth paying because it mitigates the risks that would come from moving too quickly to a new currency. And that's the reason for it. So it's to have a managed and balanced, orderly transition. Obviously, you don't have monetary policy control, but we don't at present. So it's neutral to what's happening at the moment. And what happens the day before independence will happen the day after it. And you focus on everything else, getting the government set up, creating a central bank, crucially appointing someone who is credible in the view of the world markets to lead the central bank. All of these things are the priority.
But given that you accept that you would not have an independent monetary policy in this transition period, particularly as defined by the European Union, in that period, you could not join the European Union.
Well, what's certainly true is that it's a unique situation. No one has gone out and gone back in. No one has joined in these terms and in this way. Scotland's been a member as part of the United Kingdom for 45 or more years. What the acquis says on the matter of currency or monetary policy is simply that member states should treat their exchange rates as a matter of common concern. What that really means, of course, is that you don't use your exchange rate to unfairly compete within the single market, and we wouldn't be doing that. Whether or not we're allowed to join in advance of having our own currency will really be a matter for the European Union.
That's highly unlikely, isn't it, Andrew Wilson? I mean, it's highly unlikely that the European Union would allow you to join, as opposed to discuss joining, even maybe do some negotiations, go through the principles involved, but to allow you to join when you have the currency of a nation whose explicit policy is to divert from the EU. I mean, I think we can both agree that ain't going to happen.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think there is incentive for the EU to have Scotland back as a member state. We would like to join. The whole point of having this argument at the moment is because we're out the EU against our expressed wishes. I think we can, but it will take time. I mean, it will take a couple of years.
Hold on, Andrew. Are you saying that you could join the EU?
Yes.
With Stalin?
Yes, I believe that we can, but this will be a matter not for me, not for even for the Scottish government. It will be a matter for the EU to decide.
But what possible evidence do you have for that? You're using the currency of a country that isn't even in the EU. The EU has its own currency, but you don't want to use that. You would not have an independent central bank as defined by the EU and what it demands. You wouldn't have an independent monetary policy. You wouldn't be setting your own interest rates. I mean, it's inconceivable that you could join with Stalin.
Well, I don't think any of those things are inconceivable in terms of membership. We would have our own central bank. It would be independent, but it wouldn't be setting interest rates or it wouldn't be ordering the exchange rate.
And it wouldn't have the power to print money, and it wouldn't be a lender of last resort because you're not printing money. And all of these are conditions for joining the EU, not just the Eurozone. They're conditions for being in the EU.
Well, none of those things are actually set out in the IKEA stands, but we would be a lender of last resort. So the central bank and its regulator would be a lender of last resort to the domestic Scottish banks. So that would be the case. We would have a central bank in much the way as the Euro member states have their own central banks at present. It wouldn't have all the functions of the Bank of England. But this is the orderly way to do it. What the EU wouldn't want is for Scotland to be joining the EU, going through a disorderly process of independence from the United Kingdom. I think they would be much more interested in Scotland having an economy which was stable, which was growing, and that the institutions were being set up in an orderly manner. So that's the plan that we have recommended to the Scottish government.
Can you point to anything, either in the acquis or in European law or in statements by senior European figures, that would indicate that you could join the EU with sterling as your currency?
Well, there's no precedent, Andrew. That much is true.
Could you point to anybody that said they would do something unprecedented?
But we're coming out of the United Kingdom. Ireland did this the same way. It kept the United Kingdom currency for a period of 6 years, albeit a completely different era. And then
the rules for then it was the European economic
community. It was way before that.
The rules were entirely different.
All I'm saying is that the precedent for doing this was set by Ireland long ago. There is no precedent for this going into the European Union. Of course there isn't. But Scotland is already fully compliant with almost all of the requirements to be EU member state. We would need to set up some institutions, chiefly a central bank. I think we would be a great counterparty and an excellent EU citizen state. So I do believe.
But you may think all that, but I know, the EU has to agree that.
Indeed.
And I can find no indication. I mean, I look at even the rules that they give for a country like Montenegro or others coming in. They've got to have independent central banks, ability to print money, set their own interest rates, all the rest of it. You will have none of that. These are important powers that will stay with the Bank of England in this period.
Yeah, and I think it's the orderly way to do it. Now, whether or not the European Union accepts Scotland as a member remains to be seen. I believe they will. That certainly is going to be our intent as a country, or at least I hope it will. And I think this is the best. The alternative is less orderly, and it would probably delay Scotland's accession because it would take longer for Scotland to properly create the institutions and the stability that we need.
It's not just the currency that's a roadblock to you joining the EU. You need to meet the EU's stability pact conditions, and that includes deficits, budget deficits, below 3% of GDP. Now, even before COVID struck, Scotland's deficit was almost 9% of GDP. So it would, unless you want to slash public spending immediately, it would take you years to get to the stability pact's conditions.
Well, again, we'll see what the starting point looks like when we get to it, because the fiscal position at the moment is obviously unusual. The Stability Pact is suspended. But what's interesting is you don't have to achieve the Stability Pact to join. I mean, the precedent there, Croatia, Poland, Hungary were all not performing to Stability Pact deficit levels when they joined, indeed continued to not do for some time. But what definitely needs to happen is that you have set up your financial governance such that you're on a glide path to achieve it. Now, interestingly, at this moment, Andrew, if you look at the IMF statements in their fiscal report in the autumn, they were arguing that countries focusing on Britain shouldn't be belt tightening too quickly as we come out of the crisis.
Absolutely.
The need is to keep money flowing into the economy, both for life support, but also for stimulus and then for reform. So the priority for the coming 5 years or could be more must be to invest. And so I don't think normal fiscal arrangements apply. But what's also true just now, what COVID proves, is that deficits of the level you've just stated can be funded at historically low levels of interest. I mean, Croatia got a bond away the other week at 0.9% interest. Now, if Croatia can get a bond away at that level, so could Scotland. Obviously, there will be risk premiums to manage down, but I do believe that it's fundable. But you're right, we do need to get the financial arrangements in order.
But your own Growth Commission said it could take up to 10 years to meet the Stability Pact's conditions.
Absolutely, but remember, that was pre the market conditions that we have at the moment, and obviously pre-COVID.
Yeah, but there will be a return to prudence, Andrew Wilson, at some stage. That is EU policy. Of course, we're going through an unusual time, but the Stability Pact will come back in by the time you are ready to negotiate this, and absolutely, you will have to meet its conditions.
And we do, and as you're right in saying, we set that out. What I'm saying, the one point of disagreement with you is that you need to get over the Stability Pact to get in. I think the precedent's there that you don't, but you do need to be getting towards it in an orderly fashion over time. I think the key way to get deficits down around the world is by focusing on growth. I think austerity or cutting spending or indeed increasing tax at this moment in these times would be counterproductive and wouldn't achieve what they set out.
But your commission said you had to get public spending down as a percentage of GDP.
That was the method we set out, which, because exactly, we decided in the report.
Well, that's a reduction in overall spending as a percentage of the economy.
But not in cash terms. But what we were saying at that point, Andrew, was to demonstrate a conservative and prudent approach. We didn't decide to model and just assume that growth was going at above trend and therefore everything would be easy, because we were demonstrating that we could do this without getting growth up. What I'm saying to you now, and I think that the lesson for the coming 5 years is the priority for government intervention on fiscal policy must be to stimulate growth and investment so that we can both get out of the pandemic crisis, but through the reform era that comes next, deal with climate change, deal with the great harms that are happening at the moment, not least inequality. And back to the core point, why do we want to do this? Because the United Kingdom's economic performance has not served anyone over a very long period, but now more than before, it's twice as bad performance as the average for the industrialised world this year on the measures of the OECD. So the United Kingdom is both not performing economically, but also has one of the worst inequality records in Europe as well.
Well, you are assuming some pretty reasonable growth figures to try and get your budget deficit down. I mean, you're assuming average growth higher than it's been in Scotland in the past decade. You also make some pretty heroic spending assumptions. But on the growth, I want to ask you this. I mean, you think, you're on the record as saying Brexit's a serious setback to British economic growth because of all the trade friction it will introduce even with a deal. But in your own projections, you don't allow for the same serious setbacks of trade friction for an independent Scotland.
Well, I think the point here is that getting back into the European Union would be pro-growth. Back into the single market and customs union would be good for growth. Setting up the institutions of government in Scotland, which we currently pay to have in London, would be pro-growth. So these are all reasons to be optimistic.
But only 20% of your exports go to the EU. 60% go to the rest of the UK. That's where, first of all, you will still be out of the EU for quite a while. So you'll still have trade friction there. And then if you get independence, you'll have even more trade friction with the market to which you sell 60% of your exports.
If you're right, though, earlier in the interview, you were saying we wouldn't get into the EU for a period of time. And so there would be no change to the trading arrangements, either with Europe or indeed with the UK. We will see what the friction looks like with the border to our east and to our west that is being imposed, we think, by January. And we'll see what the situation is there. That is a trade-off. You are correct to identify that is a trade-off. We have to judge as a country whether it's worth it. I believe that all the evidence is, you can look to Ireland as a great example of countries who join the European Union, small countries who are able to succeed on a bigger stage, and we can cooperate in that way. and grow faster. If you say that all our eggs have to be in the basket of trading just with the rest of the UK, which is...
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm putting this to you because I don't understand the answer. About 45% of UK exports go to the EU, and you think Brexit a disaster for what that will do because of trade friction. But 60% of Scottish exports go to the rest of the UK. By definition, that's potentially an even bigger disaster. It must be.
Well, I did try to answer that. I mean, the point is that to begin with, for a period until we join the European Union, there will be no change to the arrangements on trade. When we join the European Union, then whatever the arrangements that are agreed between the United Kingdom and Europe will be what the arrangement is between Scotland and the United Kingdom. We don't know yet, and we remain... That's why we didn't in our report include it, because even now, 4 years on, we still don't know what the arrangements exactly will be. I don't believe it will be the sort of transition that you're talking about. I mean, if you even just pick another area, Canada has 85% of its exports going into the United States. They have an arrangement. They are independent. You don't have to be part of the same country to trade with it, obviously.
What would you not be spending on that is currently spent now?
Well, the markets at the moment aren't punishing any member state of the European Union in the way that you say that they would Scotland.
No, I didn't ask for the marks. I'm saying, what would you not be spending on that is currently spent now? You've admitted you'd have to contribute to the debt service of the residual UK. You've admitted you still spend money on defence, maybe different from how it's done now, but you still do that. Where would you not spend?
Well, that'll be a matter for the government at the time to choose on the basis of their electoral promises to the people. We have set out in the report that you've clearly read in detail some areas where we would do it differently. Now, defence is one where we would spend less than the United Kingdom does as a share of GDP. There will be others.
You still have to spend 2% to join NATO.
Well, you know that most of the NATO members don't have 2%. I mean, there are only three or four of them.
You're the new kid on the block. They'll want you to commit to 2%. Well, this is the EU will ask you to commit at least in principle to the euro.
What the European Union, what the other international institutions will want to see from Scotland is that it's transitioning in an orderly way, that it's respectful of its responsibilities to the rest of the UK, not least in debt interest, but in other areas, that it takes seriously common defence challenges. All of these things is what Scotland would require to set out.
I have no idea what you're going to cut. Well, to make any kind of inroad into that £15 billion deficit.
So the point, again, we covered it a few minutes ago. The point of the moment is even the IMF are arguing that countries should not be cutting to reduce their deficits for the foreseeable future. The priority should be on investing for growth. And
the IMF is talking about countries with established currencies, with a long track record of borrowing and not defaulting, and with independent central banks, and with the ability to print money. None of that applies to an independent Scotland.
I don't understand why you are referring all of the time to the ability to print money, because there is no evidence in economic history that monetary policy or the ability to print money is a route to economic growth and success. It can buy time to stabilise during times of crisis or fluctuations. But if QE and printing money was the route to success, Britain would be the best performing economy and Japan would be the second best. Neither of those are true. In truth, over time, the focus of economic policy should be on growth, productivity, and over time, and being honest about the fact that change and transformation takes a generation. It's not done tonight.
The reason I mentioned printing money is because I see an increasing number of SNP supporters saying that budget problems, as deficit, all of that could be solved by reference to modern monetary theory, which is the printing of money, basically. Well, do you accept that that's incompatible with EU membership?
100% I accept that. And it's one of the things which is, that just funnily enough, looking at the acquis to which you were referring and central, you know, the monetary financing of the government by the central bank is not allowed. So right. MMT is a theory which I think would be a colossal error for any country right now, but certainly for a new country like Scotland on the
path. But some of the rising forces in your party, a chap called Tim Rideout, he's been promoting it. Another chap called Chris Hanlon, he is now your SNP policy convener. They're all pushing this.
Well, people are allowed in political parties to take differing points of view on differing things.
Yeah, but they're key to setting policy. Are you not really at the centre of setting policy anymore?
All I've done is produce a report with members of a commission, some of whom are now cabinet secretaries. That is the party policy. Now, people can promote MMT. It is a thing that's alive in the world. Its adherents are almost religious in their zeal. It could be possible, maybe in America, maybe in China. It's not possible for a small country.
Well, the final question to you then, if you are still setting the direction of policy in this for the SNP, Chris Hanlon, as I said, your SNP policy convener now, who is pro-modern monetary theory, the printing of money, he says you should take no share of national debt at all. He even accepts that the financial services industry in Scotland, which is large, will decline. And his comment on that was, and good riddance to it. Yes, now, is that the serious words of a serious party that is going to have to establish its financial bona fides?
Well, it's not the party's policy or position, Andrew. I mean,
he's the policy convener.
But every political party, you could pick individuals who hold posts at whatever level and find things that don't agree with the party. It is not. It's not what's in the report. It won't be what's in the white paper for a referendum. It won't be what a Scottish government does. And of course, the financial services sector is hugely important to Scotland, employing tens of
thousands. So not good riddance to it.
Quite the opposite. We would want to be a home for financial services. And in actual fact, going back into the European Union, the ability for companies and asset management and other areas of finance and pensions and so on, there would be an attraction to being located in Scotland rather than out with the European Union.
Okay, we'll leave it there, Andrew Wilson. We thank you for your time and going through all these complicated issues with you. It's a fascinating discussion, and a very Merry Christmas to you.
And to you.
Now, you can go to spectator.co.uk/cheers to get our Christmas offer. 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, a free bottle of Port Roger champagne. Terms and conditions apply. It's not a year any of us will forget anytime soon. So what were some of the highs? Because there were many of those of the year. Katie and James join me again now, together with Spectator columnist Rod Little. It might be easier to think about the lows, but let's come up with some highlights to cheer us all up. Rod, what was your highlight of the year?
I think the disappointing though this government has been, there has been a kickback to a certain degree, certainly later in the year, against the sort of wokeness which we've experienced for the last 10, 15 years. Now, I might be speaking too soon. I seem to remember saying the same thing a couple of years ago, that we had reached the peak of this idiocy. But a few of the things, particularly from people like Kenny Badenoch, but also beyond the government in the decision over the Tavistock Clinic. The Tavistock Clinic is no longer going to be carrying out its bizarre experiments on children. I think that all that stuff has suddenly become... I think there's a kickback from the public and beginning to be a kickback from the establishment. I think some of that's been hidden by COVID. I think COVID has kind of draped a shroud over a lot of the year, and that the ordinary voice of the people in the country hasn't been heard, as I was writing this week in the Spectator. So, for example, Black Lives Matter got a lot more traction, I think, than it would have done had there been a clear voice from the public objecting to Black Lives Matter. And I think you saw with the problems at Millwall, Colchester, West Ham, and indeed in the USA, in Dallas, I think it was, that actually when BLM is put before the public, there is a lot of booing. So I think there has been a kickback against wokeism, and that would be my highlight of the year. But not a great year, Andrew, I think we have to say.
No, I think we can agree with that. And from a long list of lows, what is particularly low in your mind?
If you think back exactly 1 year, this was a country filled with confidence, with a government which had a working and decently sized majority for the first time in a considerable period of time, and a sense that stuff was going to get done. We had a high opinion of our Prime Minister, who, for whatever had been said about him previously, had ushered through in a particularly hooliganish manner Brexit through the House of Commons, and now that was going to get done. And we seem to be heading in the right direction. I voted Conservative a year ago, this week, last week, with that sense of optimism. it didn't take very long for that to go. I think the problem was, as it always is, events, dear boy. But COVID discombobulated the government. It revealed a government which could simultaneously be lackadaisical and incompetent, and now overreaching. And I think a disappointment with Boris and his singular cabinet is the greatest low of the year by some distance.
Was there a time, when you began to think that perhaps the Prime Minister was not a Prime Minister for COVID times, that whatever qualities he had, they were not the qualities required to get us through a pandemic?
Yes, I think that's exactly the case. And certainly his defenders, and I spoke to Tom Bower when he was writing his book about Boris Johnson, and Tom was very, very much pro-Boris, I have to say, which is unusual for Tom Bower to be in favour of one of his subjects. But his argument was that he was the wrong man for the wrong times. Fair enough. There is a counter-argument which would say that Boris Johnson wanted to have been the Prime Minister, but did not very much enjoy being Prime Minister and could not do it terribly well. And I think, you know, the first month, I think 20 million people came into the country before we actually started to close our borders. It was absolutely clear at that point, and this was at a time when we didn't know very much about COVID. We didn't know about its comparatively benign lethality, for example. But that I don't think the government took it seriously enough then. We were late to lockdown, we were late to close the borders. And within government itself, you actually saw the Prime Minister. I think he was the first, other than in Iran, the first leader of a country to cop the virus. And into hospital he went. And it just gave you a kind of indication that they weren't taking this particularly seriously. And that has continued with, I think it was between April and June, there were 12 U-turns on policy. Now, there are caveats. There are caveats. This was a horrible thing to deal with, and no one had dealt with it before. And you might also blame some of our pre-planning that wasn't taken terribly seriously. But then again, it was a bit like the kind of pre-planning you get when Lembit Opik crops up every few years to tell us that a comet is going to hit the Earth at some point in time. It is one of those imponderable...
Or a meteorite.
Well, one day someone will be right. So there are caveats, but even so, I don't think it has been terribly, terribly well handled.
Okay, James, what was your high of the year?
So I think the highlight actually has to be the Western world's reaction to China's attempt to bully Australia following Australia calling for an independent inquiry into the origins of the virus. I think it's remarkable that if you think back just to the start of this year, the UK was going to ask Huawei, a company with very close links to the People's Liberation Army, to build the UK's, to play a crucial role in building the UK's 5G network. That's now not going to happen. And I think the way that the Chinese government have behaved with their kind of wolf warrior diplomacy as this pandemic was raging, the extreme misinformation trying to suggest the US military was responsible, the attempt to bully Australia, has, I think, alerted the Western world to the threat that is posed by communist China, and not before time. And I think the big question about 2021 is, can the Western world get its act together to counter China? And that's going to require much more cooperation on technology among the Western democratic states. It's going to require a policy designed to contain China, working with Japan, India, South Korea, Australia, you know, all of those countries in the neighbourhood. And I think this is a moment now when the West can push back on China, because I think the West was risking sleepwalking into a world where China became the hegemon, and that would not be a comfortable place for any democratic state.
Okay, James. Katie, your high of the year?
I'm going to keep it simple, the vaccine. And that's enlarged, because I think it's probably the biggest reason or hope we have that 2021 is not going to be much like 2020. Still a few hurdles, but I think while we now know the Pfizer vaccine is very effective, fingers being crossed for Moderna, for also Oxford, AstraZeneca. There was a moment, you know, a few months ago, 6 months ago, when this was very much in doubt, and you heard a lot about the fact that often you just don't get effective vaccines for various diseases, particularly coronaviruses. So I think the fact that that has come off and completely changes the political landscape, it does feel as though we now have a solution which hopefully with the rollout will be the best one and the simplest.
And Rod, where are we on the culture wars? Now, you referred that they perhaps hadn't got the same attention they would have done because COVID is all consuming and just sucks the oxygen out of everything else. From your point of view, do you think there will be more pushback in these culture wars in 2021 and that those who think they've been on the winning side may find things more difficult?
I don't know. I think there's certainly going to be pushback by the people. Because this stuff simply doesn't have hegemony. It just has no weight whatsoever up and down the country. And it was one of the reasons that Boris won that huge majority. You know, that 80-seat majority was acquired at least partly through traditional Labour voters who were not merely sick of Jeremy Corbyn, not merely wishing to see Brexit done, as we kept being told, but actually wanted to be governed by a government which had some patriotism about it. Patriotism is one of the big issues, but was also less inclined to occupy itself with the divisiveness of identity politics. And the divisiveness of identity politics is the thing which is wrecking the Labour Party at the moment, and still is, even under the much more placatory Keir Starmer. The question then is, once Dominic Cummings has gone, and I think Dominic was probably a force behind this move to push back against wokeism, as has some other advisers around Boris Johnson, if that lot continues to have some sort of sway, then I think we will see a pushback by the government. But I'm beginning to worry a little bit because Cummings, of course, has been jettisoned.
Okay, I'm going to finish up with a couple of yes-no questions, ask you to put your Mystic Meg crystal balls in front of you. And here's the first question. Will Boris Johnson still be Prime Minister at this time next year? Katie?
Yes. I do think if there was no vaccine, if we got to spring and he was announcing severe restrictions still, there's a chance there would have been a leadership challenge. I think if the vaccine works out, though, he's in a much safer place. So I think he will be.
James?
Yes, I think Katie's analysis is correct.
Rod?
Yes, with the caveat, if there was an inquiry into what happened in our care homes in February and March, then I think that could rebound very, very badly against the Prime Minister. I think that is the one area where he is really vulnerable.
Okay. And my second question, final question for the year is, by this time next year, will we largely be in a situation of few restrictions because of COVID? I don't say total return to normality, but largely out of the lockdown tier system approach. Still doing some things differently, but pretty much not the way we've been in 2020. James?
Yeah, I'd go further than that, Andrew. I think that by this time next year, nightclubs and all the clubs which are seen as the last thing they'll be allowed to open, I think even they'll be open. I think the vaccination program will have allowed you to go back to normal. Now, individuals might choose to carry on wearing masks on public transport and the like, but I think Boris Johnson is very keen to have a moment when all of the COVID rules and restrictions go at once. I think he is aware that if you don't do that, it becomes like rationing after the war. It just hangs around for ages, that you have to at some point pull the plaster off.
Katie?
I'm going to say a hopeful yes, but I do think it rests on the Oxford vaccine being approved, and we should hopefully know in the next few weeks, but I think that's quite critical to all of this.
And Rod?
No, we will be in exactly the same position, I fear, or very, very similar to it. The history of this crisis has been one of the government telling us that 3 months down the line, we will be kind of back to normal, or at least a lot better off. We're currently being told it's Easter. I don't believe that for a single nanosecond. I think this will continue and continue until we learn to franchise the population with the responsibility for dealing with the virus in their own way. Otherwise, I think, no, this will just continue. And the vaccine, which is great news, of course, we may need 2 or 3 shots per year. You've got to sell this vaccine to a population, which a proportion of which is sceptical, which may not last very long, while simultaneously telling it that even if it has the vaccine, you still have to socially distance, wear your masks and not mix too much. I think we're in for a pretty rough year.
There we go. We've got your predictions. Thank you for that. Rod, Katie, James, thanks for joining us, and a Merry Christmas to you all. For those Merry of Christmas. You who want to hear more from Rod, especially on his pop music reviews, yeah, he does them too, just subscribe to The Spectator magazine. The link is on the screen. There's a special discount for Owen Jones because he does so much digital archaeology on the website, particularly on Rod, that we thought we would give him a bulk discount. Merry Christmas to you, Mr. Jones, as well. That's it for this week, indeed for this year. Thanks to our other guests, once again to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley, who've extended the sponsorship of this show into 2021. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. We're delighted to be partners with them. Remember, subscribe to The Spectator in our Christmas sale. You'll receive 12 weeks of the magazine in print and online, plus a bottle of Paul Roget champagne, which is worth 46 quid. You'll get all of that, including the champagne, for just 12. What a bargain. Even Santa Claus won't bring you something as good as that. Please note, though, this is a UK offer only. Terms and conditions apply. They can all be read on our website. But to claim your 12 weeks of the Specky, and a free bottle of Paul Roget, go to spectator.co.uk/cheers. And if you subscribe before Saturday the 19th, you'll also receive this year's Christmas edition as a bonus. It's a fantastic triple edition. Katie, James, Rod, they're all in it. Marvellous reading to get you through the holiday season. As always, send us your thoughts on Spectator TV to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. That's spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. We hope you'll join us again in the new year. We'll be back on Thursday, January the 7th. Until then, have a very Merry Christmas, and we all hope a much improved new year. Bye-bye.